Bonner for a minute. Huh. We had a long discussion with him with Rudy Split when I was over in Bonner about a year ago. But I never did gather how much, you know, actual Peter Mundy, let's say people like you, input was into the filing. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
But it was too late. The main input that we had was Spain up to the court. The soldiers came. Either the army and also the SS.
Right.
They came, they spent some time on the piston, number 7 and 10.
Right after the movie.
That's
after they came out of a place like the Hyderabad, I presume.
They were the same workers, yeah. I didn't know much about it. But when they came, we trained them right there on the theory, on the apparatus, on how they were fixed, and we were to look for troubleshooting devices on the spot. And then we marched off. Now we had some high level trainer there too, a lieutenant, for instance, pretty high level, a captain, Hoffman,
and
who did this participation. Thank you. See, very good training, all that was done militarily. We used to be there from there, kind of civilian engineers, telling them along. Very similar to what we did here with the Italians, by the way. The Italians, we trained here on the restaurant, this time.
Right, yeah.
So that was one type of interest. Then came only questions. The front had turned that we had nothing to do with the targeting. Nothing to do with the military fanatics of how you would do it. But when some trouble developed on the hearing apparatus or on the mixture aid or on some of the problem areas, there would either come questions or would say, hey, why don't you go and take a look at what it is the trouble is there. So on a consulting, spontaneous consulting, none of that basis, would one or the other go depending on what the problem was. And that's all we had.
Did you go out, very often? Do you remember any specific?
No, I don't know. Just one.
That in the hall.
On that particular set came from headquarters.
Yeah.
Several orders, you go and do this and that. And I have made my way to trust the night attack to the areas where we do what we call near the Denmark. And then I approached one position where came out and bent over me right over here, and there was a truck soldier. He bent in and he bent over me and then into the cemetery.
That was short range fire.
Very short range fire, right over my head. Yeah. And that was the battery that had problems. So I saw they had problems. I think,
Did you ever meet General Heinemann, for example? Did you know General Heinemann?
Well, I met a number of generals out there. Okay. There was also a lot of the government experts out there.
Yeah.
And there was the problem between the government and the army and who would do what.
Right, I know. You know.
The uniform and all that.
I've got a little tremendous.
But on my way out, I was stopped at headquarters. Before you went, next step in Crossland on, and there I met people and had the name that
you'd have forgotten that, you
know. No.
Yeah, of course, the head of that whole operation was Kammler by then.
Yes,
Kammler.
Yes, I know that.
Society. I just got a long dossier from him, about him, rather, from the Berlin Documentation Center, which is about 10 pages long. I mean, a complete dossier of what he did, but I still haven't gotten a picture of him. I went into the Bundesarchiv in Koblenz, the Military Institute at Freiburg, outside at the various centers, the Deutsche Museum, and so forth. But I haven't gotten a picture of it yet. Have you ever seen a picture of it? Now, you folks have a great collection of photos, I understand. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but
that's what they tell me in Huntsville.
No, I may have had a picture, but I certainly don't know whether I do have one or not. I don't think that.
I'd like to ask you a little later.
Yeah.
So, So you know, you then went to the front on this one occasion,
yes,
to help correct the.
Right.
Now, how about this another area of interest to me, or other problems that might have been involved with frontline missiles? How often did these people come back to you, or to people, anybody at Kingdom Monday, regarding the state of logistics and supply problems? I understand they had a lot of difficulty moving things through the into the logistics chain. And
yeah, I know there were a lot of problems. Also, there were a lot of these bridges that were shut down by airplane attack. There was quite a bit of correspondence, questions, and quite a bit of people going back and forth. What way do you measure that?
The trouble, we've had a long discussion with General Dornberg, in fact, he was in Huntsville on the way down to Mexico last time, and he talked about some of these areas, but the problem seems very strange, but because he was cut off from a lot of the operational problems when Tamla moved in. I've got the military material, and I've got translations. We have Ruth Heimberg, Carl Heimberg's daughter, working, Rudy von Thormer, working on translations for us as we bring the documents in. But I still have a block of an empty space, let's say, on the operational end.
In other words, where
Dornberger stopped having influence. One point, you see, when Kamala moved in, I have all this information on the military side, but I'd never quite figure out what the interplay was between
you. You are looking for an order of the relationship, and I don't think
there wasn't. It was just probably like just chaotic.
While one part was already under Kamala, the other part was not yet. The command kept
changing all the time. The two or three generals went in there.
The situation changed continuously, and eventually the Russians were coming there.
Right.
And the British and Americans were coming there, and then we decided to go right down to the south. And started that. In the meantime, we still had an order to keep on developing. Hitler was still talking about developing, so we went to the south. The south mines, and I had the order to move to the Nidaboga Heide and do some further launches,
So where was this now?
The Nidaboga Heide?
Yeah, what launches did you make there?
None. We were only focused. While we were still looking for a bit where we would do it, where we moved further. Allied came in to that area. And so I was still looking for a long side when the order came to go to Darmen. That was the team to leave in the Lüneburger Heide.
Lüneburger Heide, I see. That's one of the questions. I've forgotten who now, but I just haven't made a note here. Somebody talked about firing. What was the idea of the lost convoy? What's that supposed to mean? Have you ever heard that term? Some convoy that got lost? Regarding from the trip south from Kingdom Monday.
Yeah, it was lost in peace.
What was that? Yeah, that story.
My convoy, the 10th and 7th, got mobilized. We packed everything we could have and put it in a gear, operating gear, and went south into the Lüneburger Heide. Now, while we were doing that, we got more and more intimidated, so we had to disperse
the convoy.
Disperse the convoy, because the convoy would be very obvious. And I was going into A-10, and some of the possible bases were to launch bomb against Ukraine. And into the North Sea. Not to hit England, because not into the deep, not into the Baltic anymore, but to develop a new heart shooting area in the North Sea. Now,
from the lunar by the hiatus.
From the lunar by the hiatus.
Right.
Yes, it takes
long. Yeah, it takes long. That
never happened.
Yeah.
And as we were counting our positive rays, we got these stays in contact with Dr. Van Braun and his headquarters, who then somewhere, I don't know how, but they then started some other day, probably also by horse. And as the Allies came from the approach more and more direct, and the entering came to the Rhine, to Remagen and so on, we got the word to get down to the Garmisch Partenkirchen. And so we then started to go south, and in a very few weeks, we got gradually our duties back. Now, the last convoy probably relates to that some of the trucks decided to go right into place, and some of the people found concluded that the war was lost and any further launches was just put to see where they took their truck or put them in the sea and shot them
right into the lake.
So what a rush! So what arrived was rudimentary rest pieces of the origin convoy. So the convoy went in various places.
Yeah. Now, what group are you with? I mean, just review the group. If you left, as a group. This is all the test stand personnel.
Test stand seven
personnel.
Right. Yeah.
Who was that? You in charge of that at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's probably what the people really
I wonder. Right.
It was kind of a lot. We had major contracts. I put my position out every month in a while.
Do you remember when you actually left, the date you left, the thing about the approximate date? Was it sometime in March, would you think? Or 45?
Well, I have letters from a man who has a lot of knowledge and sent me a map, which I don't have here, but in my home, where he had to toll the tracks, where these trucks went and who went where. Yes, in a modern German map, yes.
That would be very handy to see sometimes. Yeah.
And I think he may have dates. He has books, notebooks, and he has gave me back a lot of names I had forgotten. Mm-hmm. And he writes very accurately, 5, 6, 7 pages in the space. How he moved barracks and a lot of these things that I have long forgotten. But he recalls.
Was he on your team? Or?
Yes, he was on my team.
You know, who was he? In Germany?
Harvest is his name.
Harvest.
He was in Germany.
In Germany. Would it be possible sometime to see that map? Or
but I have it at home.
Well, maybe another occasion I'd like to look at.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, good.
Sure, and he asked me whether I remember that. And some of it I do, some of it I don't. And there are a lot of details of the movement. Dr. Greta, for instance, stayed in Vida at that time, he went further south. Stayed there. It became chaotic everybody tried to escape from the Russians who came from this side, and it became more narrow, and so we looked where we could go, and finally ended up in that northern, north of Garmisch, in an area where we that's where we met.
That's where you met.
And Brown went still further south with his arm, like an open arm.
He was over in York.
And then we waited for being overhauled by the Americans. And they came. And with the first boat that came to our window, which was an interpreter, a captain.
Do you remember any of the names of the early Americans?
Well, very lonely young, and who knew that you were there, who was dispatched for us.
You don't remember his name, do you?
No.
Ray
was a very nice guy.
Yeah. And they began.
And here the local population has said that these are all what they call the werewolves or something, those of the SPD who were told to make the last stand. Mm-hmm. What was the name? Wolf, something?
Yeah, like the werewolf. Yeah.
And of course they were not. But the tank group that came in the early lined up the whole population there. Mm-hmm. The first thing, and hands up and with a machine gun and asked and look for guns and for our werewolf material. And that was resolved by the captain very soon, who knew who we were and why we were there and cleared it up. Well, and then we all went to Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Let me go back up to Kruppstein 7 again. Do you know, was there any destruction of the facility before the final evacuation? Or any other test stand? You see, the Russians got in. I found out in Russia, which is one of the few things I got, I found out the name of the major who headed the Russian army group into Pingamon. He was a Bakuyev who went in there on the 7th of May.
Yeah.
Now, as far as I know, everybody I talked to had left Pingamundi by sometime in March. Seems to be the 25th of March is about the latest person that I talked to that remembers the exact date. But let's assume that Pingamundi was empty during most of April. Now, do you have any knowledge at all?
Not call it knowledge. But
yeah.
I think you to recall that the discussions that they had, why we went to the West and not to the East. Because we were anti-communist.
We felt that this was where we should go,
whether it was wanted or not. Was that as little as possible should go into Russian hands, and that the destruction would be done. Now, who did it? Mm-hmm. What assignment? Who got the assignment?
Mm-hmm.
He did not.
No, it was the army personnel.
Somebody may have and probably did do as much destruction as possible. I would guess.
Yeah, but you never heard any specific.
No,
I can't get that information.
No,
they're very hard.
Yeah.
So let's see. Now, did you ever go into the Heidelager, Heidekraut?
No,
never got out there. I got Zeiler, I think, told me that. I showed him today. I knew he was out there, and I just got a stack of pictures. I'll show you one or two. As a matter of interest, that's the V2 chamber that was captured by the Polish underground, and sent off to England.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's another one up there.
The first one really, the one they got from Sweden.
That was there,
and Dr. Schubert misguided this thing.
Oh, so tell me that story.
That's
good. You know, I might get all the stories today.
Dr. Schubert was a mathematician, and there was a guidance developed, a joystick,
That's for the bottom.
And somebody has a great idea to use it in a V2 and guide the V2 into the proper thing. And so that steering mechanism, that radio frequency guidance, was built into a V2, and the V2 was sitting in the wall and put some 7 there. And Dr. Schubert was sitting outside the wall, and Dr. Schilling and I looked at him, and he was sitting there, and he shook. He literally shook.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Dr. Schubert, what, are you afraid?" He had never seen one before. And so he did shake.
Mm-hmm.
And so we offered to wait and not shoot. He said, no, go ahead. So we went ahead, and when that V2 came out, he literally shook the damn thing into this direction. And I'm a person witness for that, and so it's a big thing. And so that thing went crisscross and impacted in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was loused up by Dr. Schubert, no question. And Dr. Schubert disappeared then later on. I think he probably still around. And that is the one that Sweden picked up and sent to Britain.
To the British, right, yeah.
And then I was in Cuxhaven for the British. We were doing several launches there after in the late 45. Yeah. During the summer of 45. During that time, the British
opposite.
And the singer must have been Captain or Colonel of France.
That's Saunders? Saunders?
Right hand?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, that's the one who denied it. He remembered it very well.
And he is the one who flew in one of these very high-flying conceptions, this private conception,
mm-hmm.
was Peter, I think, was the name.
Mosquito.
Over Tristan Sheldon, and we had one sitting there, and we corresponded at the time, and he was up there, and we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And we could identify the given time, and he saw what he knew was there, and mm-hmm. he knew he was there.
Right.
And that was around the time, but shortly after an attack, then I decided to launch, because the V2 was damaged, the crane was damaged, we couldn't get it down, one of the twin rudders was vanished, we couldn't fix it, the only way to derail it was longer than we did.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't go very far, but it flew some 80 or 90 kilometers or so. Mm-hmm. And then we made our top-secret report on it, and later I got that thing back and ran up and down and said, who is the idiot who launched this thing at this time? I wrote him back and said, I am the idiot who wrote this, who was not, because you couldn't be reached at the time I needed you, etc.
Okay.
I wasn't in his destroy anyway.
Right. You were there.
I was sunset.
Yeah,
so we had a great fun on these things. By the way, he knew a great deal about this Swedish recovery there.
Yeah, we got the report on the Swedish, called the Swedish report. It's a Pawnborough report. In fact, I was in Pawnborough about 3 months ago. And I even got pictures of it. It's quite interesting.
Wasn't that the very first one?
Yeah, that was the first.
The one that cautioned.
That's right.
That somebody was cooking there.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
That also gave him some ideas of what's happening at the North Sea,
mm-hmm.
the underground land source.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's then the
We've got all that material in there. The Schubert that launched this, which Schubert was this? What would you remember his first name just for identification purposes? But he was from where? What organization?
He was probably from the mathematical, from Dr. Geisler's area.
Geisler's area,
Schubert.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We got two. He could also be from Helsel.
From
Helsel and Hansel. Yeah. Readily answer that question.
Okay, I'll ask those.
I don't know if
it's been very.
Very long hair.
Yeah. Long hair, no days, huh?
Premature hippie.
Yeah, real premature hippie.
Yeah.
Well, are there any other specific stories or anecdotes, particularly interesting things? How, for example, I'm doing the raid, did that affect you adversely or anything else?
Oh, yes.
Of course, the first big British raid.
18 August.
Yeah, 17 actually.
Yeah.
Night of 17, 18. Well, that night. Yeah, I've got incredible. I have all the British pictures of this during the raid. I have all the photographs taken prior to the raid and also after the raid, which is quite interesting. I talked to them in England, there's mostly the photo interpreters and people like that. And I thought, it's an interesting collection of material. And I wondered how badly did this affect you, your personal operation? Where were you that night?
In the bunker. I was sitting with Dr. Dunberger, Dr. Steinhaus, Hannah Reich, and I think Dr. von Braun's brother.
Mm-hmm.
He and Dunberger had just come back from the hunt. They had hunted the ducks and got a few. And so we had a few drinks together in the Opera Club. Hannah Reich reported about some of her things. It was a very interesting evening, by the way. And then when I went to bed into the... I was in a guest house at the interim when the proper, not yet in Cinerix, but I was there. Had a room there. And the silence went off as many times, and I did not go into the bunker. But then I saw called Christmas tree. So I thought, time, and I packed my camera, the left camera, and went to the bunker there. And that was us. Somebody came in without the shoes.
Yeah, he told about that. He said, boots. Yeah, I got all that stuff. Right.
And then we went out after the attack and started to distinguished by it, so it could be went to our myth house, it was called in Vietnam, our headquarters, where a lot of cables were in flames, and a lot of equipment in flames, and the kids and stuff, kids were not established later on. And then reports came in about the population in the quarters of the south.
Yeah. Did you feel that this hurt your testing badly, this ray? Was it very effective?
Yeah, it did affect the testing. It affected mainly the plant production.
Pre-production plant there, yeah.
And it's been estimated, this is where I have to go, that it delayed, that this attack and the following, but this particular attack delayed the possible deployment of the troops by about a year now. Whether that's true or not.
No, you get different figures, that's the trouble. But anyway, you know, for 6 months to a year, who knows? You never would, really wouldn't know.
Very hard to say.
But that, of course, led to the transfer of the launching operations to the Polish area, of course.
Not necessarily, because the launching, these were two different types of launches. The area was more or less field type launches, done by soldiers.
Yeah, but if it weren't for the raid, would you think those launches would have still moved out to Poland? That would be the question. Do you think so anyway? So the raid maybe hastened that a little bit, but But how much launching did you do?
What was affected was one of the aggregates where static testing would be done. Now what we did was we didn't static test anymore. We moved right out and flew with the weak load. There were weak loads, a great deal of those things. Several hundred of them, 600, 700, 800 of them as a development type thing, because there was no telemetry. So the telemetry that was developed had no response time. You couldn't, for instance, find out vibration. We had a time when these things came back, about, well, memory serves right, 10 out of 50. Very suddenly, about 15, 20 seconds after liftoff, got color, boom, it stopped right over us and came back slowly. And what was that? So we had suspicion. We thought that we suspected the cutoff delay. But why would the cutoff delay go? Perhaps the vibration. So could we measure vibrations? No.
We couldn't vibrate.
Well, we put one on the test bench. The place where this delay was didn't indicate vibration. The thermometer was very available, but you had to use an oscillograph on the ground. You couldn't transmit it via eye. So I had the idea to use an oscillograph and put some wires to the detour. So at that time the other work, West developed a glide bomb. There was a bot sitting out there where the airplane shot down bombs and guided these bombs to the ship.
To the ship, right.
And that was done with a new invention that was spool. And while it was bronze wire, a very high speed wire, that would fly off. Now you use that today on a five-way fishing. That is the invention.
Yes,
and at that time it was a new invention, first time. And those were spools in order to have low inertia, or non-inertia. Only the wire would fly itself off by the gliding bomb. You wouldn't have an acceleration of that spool. And that worked very fine. Now I took two of these spools, put them on the ground, and put the wires into the instrument compartment, and put an accelerometer to this cut-off delay fixed in the wire. And while the thing was flying, we still got. That was the status of the non-availability of telemetry. And we found a 35 cycle vibration on that fixing device. The cutoff delay was mounted, and that was the explanation. Would get excited, would close, and I'd go to cutoff. Now, the fix was very easy after that. But this telemetry available, it took that many birds to launch, and One unresolved area was the so-called Luftzerleger. That was those that would come and all of a sudden blow up
the air
without the other. Yes. And there were several attacks called to that. One was in Heidelager, one pound went to the interject. I looked at them. And we as the Christians shot about 10 vertically. We shot them vertically without a program and let the earth change, move them slightly out, and we had telescopes that had a 90 degree angle. In other words, you looked this way, but in reality it was standing upright. It gave you a more secure set of security. You were looking that way. And then you could see them. And we saw them coming in, tail first, and all of a sudden a tremendous acceleration and a snapping force, and the air pressure would put them into the air stability, which was probably the beginning of these air burns. It was never finally... Reinhard Bonn is going to tell you he knew what it was, but he knew it was.
So the real reason... But it was reduced towards the end of the...
Well, there were all kind of fixes. There was glass wool put in.
Glass insulation.
Tanks,
yeah.
Glass wool, the things. And there were mountains of these glass wool. It was called the fixes.
Yeah.
So another thing.
Well, I heard it. But go ahead, say it again. I'd like to...
No. The glass wool was fixed to fixes. And we had some that were riveted and some that were crude, and there were non-indical tensors, it was thin structure with the tank
separated.
And the flutter was a possibility because the pressure does separate very rapidly over the OGI profile that we two had at about, a yard, a meter down from the tip. It was never
really.
The air and probably at the same time. Well, and a great number of launches were done for these types of research. Another type was